Now, I guess the place for a rabbi to begin is with a confession. I am not an anti-Semitologist. It's a word I coined to describe somebody who's an expert in anti-Semitism. I looked back the other day on the over 750 lectures that I've given from the temple pulpit in the last 25 years, and I realized that at no time had I ever discussed anti-Semitism in and of itself. Obviously, anti-Semitism intrudes on many of the issues that involve Jewish life. But as I always looked, frankly, on anti-Semitism as the minister's problem, the priest's problem, the guru's problem, and not my problem, I'll worry about the soul of Jews, and I'll let them worry about the soul of their own. Which I think is to say that I want to deal this evening with not the theme of how to deal with anti-Semitism. I'm not so sure it can be dealt with in a basic sense, but with a different kind of question. Why is it that in 1980, many in the American Jewish community seemed for the first time in a long time to have lost their cool about anti-Semitism? Why suddenly all across this country were Jewish community centers and synagogues and federations holding hand-wringing meetings about anti-Semitism? What I call Oigavalk meetings. Swastika dubbings, cross burnings, ugly words about Jews are certainly no novelty on the world scene. They've been around for centuries. I'm convinced that we've got to deal with our own problem tonight and ask why it is that we've reacted the way we have, what it says about us. And the place to begin, I think, is the recognition that we live in the real world. That, I think, is the meaning of the election of 1980. It's the beginning of the recognition that most of us have come to, that American power is not unlimited, American prosperity is not ever growing, that it's not a God-given truth that our children will live better in a material sense than we have lived. I'm convinced, if you would press me, that anti-Semitism will be a reality in our world in 2181 and 2281 and 2381, just as it is today. I'm convinced that there's such a thing as a herd instinct that is innate to the human species. We are created in the image of God and spiritually, but we are physically of the earth. All animal species have a sense that the stranger is somehow a danger. And as long as human beings exist, there will be groups, and as long as there will be groups, there are going to be in groups, and there are going to be out groups, and there is going to be anti-Jewish, anti-Catholic, anti-Vietnamese, anti-Igbo, anti-you name it feeling. As long as the human race continues to be as we in fact are created. Until and unless God creates, as Jeremiah once prophesied, a new breed with a new heart and a new spirit, a new kind of creation. And so one can in fact, I think, discuss intelligently what particular tactic might be useful in dealing with a particular anti-Semitic outbreak. I, for instance, would not be averse to a group of young people who came to me and said, we feel rather strong and we're well-muscled and we wouldn't mind beating up a few American Nazis when they parade. I wouldn't be the first one to say to them, well, if you do, you're going to have to come to Yom Kippur and beat your breasts. At the same time, I'm not at all convinced that the United States in 1981 is where Germany was in 1931 or even 1921. And I'm not at all convinced that the Jewish Defense League's program to create camps where young Jews can learn to be part of a paramilitary unit, to use firearms and to protect their own because, quote, no one else will protect them, is in fact the tactic which ought to be adopted now. I wouldn't rule it out as a tactic if I were in Germany in 1931. I wouldn't rule it out as a tactic if America were to change radically from what I perceive it to be. I'm not a willing victim. I'm not a pacifist. I don't believe, with all the respect to another tradition, in turning the other cheek. But on the other hand, I don't believe that the world is on the brink of another Holocaust. And I'm interested in trying to understand why it is that Jews have reacted as they have with such tension, emotion, in the past months. And as I try and analyze the situation, I'm convinced that some of us are paranoid. There's a young lawyer in the temple who came to me the other day and said that a colleague of his in his profession had told him that their next door neighbors who were Jewish, the colleague was not, had come to him and said, you know, we can't meet and be friends any longer because we can only trust our own. And that's paranoia. And that happened in Cleveland, Ohio, this fall, just a few months ago. I'm convinced that for most of us, or for many of us, we're living with a very happy double standard. Meir Kahana was in town on Sunday and Monday of this week. Meir Kahana is, as you know, a man who's convicted by Israeli courts of having been involved in a conspiracy designed to frighten, if not to kill, the Arab leaders of Hebron. And he served a 3-month sentence for that crime in Israeli jails. And yet when he appeared before congregations in our community, it was reported in our Cleveland Jewish News simply as Rabbi Meir Kahana, quote, a controversial figure, end of quote, will speak. Now, had a member of the Ku Klux Klan spoken at a local church, I doubt that we would have been satisfied if the papers had described him simply as a controversial figure, or a controversial speaker. Meir Kahana is a terrorist, and we Jews are not in the habit of calling a spade when it applies to our own. And we have been very angry, exercised, about the fact that the Ku Klux Klan has been organizing camps throughout, not throughout, but camps in the South, to which they're sending young Christians to learn how to bear arms, to make sure that blacks and Vietnamese and Jews and any other among the unwanted do not take over the nation. And yet, Meir Kahana is involved in the same kind of camp recruitment. And he made this appeal to the young people of our Jewish community, and he did so at Hillel at the university. And one of the paid representatives of Hillel encouraged people to enroll in that camp. Many of us in 1981, I submit to you, have a double standard. And I think almost all of us in 1980-81 have gotten the habit of jumping to conclusions. We're living under a shadow and we see everything within terms of that shadow. If I were to say to you tonight that two of our Cleveland synagogues had recently been torched, and that the Congregational Plenum of our Jewish Community Federation had been approached by the arsonists and told that a third synagogue would be burnt unless a large amount of money were turned over to them. I think many Jews would see a terrible anti-Semitic conspiracy, some kind of extremist group behind this. Well, this is exactly what has happened in the Roman Catholic community in the last 3 days. And in fact, it may be a member of the Roman Catholic community who was a torturer and extortionist. And it might very well be that it was a member of the Jewish community who was the torturer and the extortionist. But I suggest that in our heart of hearts, many of us, given the mood that we're in, would have jumped to a conclusion which in this case, many others, would be entirely false. 2 years ago, all of the silver implements which we keep on the Torah and the Ark and the main temple were stolen. And when the person called me to tell me of this event, they said it must be an anti-Semitic incident. Well, I'm a member of a group of the senior ministers of the town who meet together, and I knew that a lot of my fellow ministers and priests had reported to me that ritual silver was disappearing with a rather routine, way from churches all over town. As a matter of fact, the churches were losing even their stained glass windows, and it wasn't simply the silver on the candelabra. An anti-Semitic incident? Or just theft? We live in a violent world. We live in a violent city. We're part of a violent society. And one of the things that all of us are failing to do is to place this series of incidents, which Jews tend to beat their breasts about and report, in context of what the society is really like. Are we being singled out? Is it an organized conspiracy of some kind? What are we really doing? Now, I've suggested to you that I'm not one who believes in burying his head in the sand. My congregation knows me well enough to know that I'm not a passive person. I don't believe in playing the ostrich. But I'm convinced that for many of us, we've been on a rather childish emotional binge and making a number of unwarranted assumptions about what's happening. And I'm concerned about it for a number of reasons, most of which is that I think it's self-defeating. Fear exudes a certain kind of fragrance which the predator can sense. And when you run to the newspapers, you run to the media to denounce the anti-Semitism with all of the hyperbole of which we're capable, when we see every incident not as an act of delinquency, not as an act of violence, simply part of our society, but as a part of a Nazi-like conspiracy which threatens genocide to the Jewish people, we are suggesting in every way I know, to all the paranoids in our society, to all those little people who know that the only way they'll ever be noticed is if they commit a crime, that here's the way to make the headlines, here's the way to make somebody jump, here's the way to exert one's power. It's almost like the phrase, you know, a self-fulfilling prophecy. See, a fearful people is a ready prey, makes themselves ready prey, and declares themselves a victim, a ready victim, to those in the society who are willing to attack. And there are people out there ready and willing, with nothing to lose, eager to make some impress on the society itself. And I would suggest to you further that only a fool would have approached these last several years believing that the greening of America, the opening up of the American society would continue the way it had continued during the years of post-war prosperity. These have not been good years for America. We've had to accept defeat, frustration in Vietnam. We've had to accept the limitations on prosperity. But I would suggest to you also that only a fool looking at the events of the last several years would say that there is an organized, widespread, fundamentally dangerous conspiracy against Jewish survival in these United States. Look at the record. In 1973, the Arabs proclaimed an oil embargo. The oil costs began to rise because of the war with Israel. And all those bumper stickers, which all the Jews said were going to appear, you know, blaming the Jews for the oil embargo, did not in fact appear, and have not appeared. And I remind you that this country over the last years has spent over $1 billion of its own money in support of the State of Israel, $1 billion a year which might have been spent for other uses, domestic uses, and that there were large pressure groups in the United States fighting for this money who might have been tempted to use an anti-Semitic campaign in order to gain their ends, but did not. And I remind you that just a few years ago, the United States was willing to put all of its trade agreements with the Soviet Union in jeopardy in order to secure the release of Soviet Jewish prisoners of conscience. Though there were great commercial interests in the United States which were eager to see that this embargo did not go through, great costs, political costs, and no anti-Semitic campaign of a national nature was mounted. This is not the best of worlds, and this is not the worst of worlds, but it's certainly not the end of the world. And I think American Jews had better take another look at themselves, look in the mirror, and ask why the fear, why the trembling, why the hand-wringing, why the oikogots, why the hysteria. Let me try then, as I see it, to put things in context. One. Tremendous amount of fear abroad in the land, all kinds of fear. When I came back to Cleveland 25 years ago, very few of the people I knew really bothered to make sure their homes were well locked. Today, most homes of people I know have electrical sensor devices of all kinds on the doors. When I go today to make a call in one of the apartment buildings, I enter a cubicle, which the kind I used to enter when I went to visit somebody in prison. And there's a voice identification, and there's a television identification, and I've got to figure out as if I were a CIA agent, the combination of numbers which I can use on the telephone, and only then perhaps will somebody tell me the number of the apartment that I'm to go to. Tell people I'm sorry that a grandmother has died. Many people are afraid to use the city. We live in a time of fear. We live in a time of frustration. We're frustrated by the inability of our troops to gain their objectives in Vietnam. We're frustrated by the fact that we don't seem to be able to handle the economic problems which face the nation. We're frustrated by inflation, not only financially, but emotionally, because it threatens the security which all of us have assumed to underpin our lives, and we know that it threatens the survival of all the institutions which lend grace and meaning to our lives. What I'm saying very simply is that the era of goodwill is over. He went through 20 or 25 years in these United States, believing that we were, in fact, a new breed of people, more humane and more socially conscious than any other breed that had been on the face of the earth, when really what was happening was simply this, that our prosperity was so enormous and it was growing. And therefore we could allow the poor and the blacks and even our women to share a greater opportunity in the society than we had heretofore, because it didn't mean we had to give up anything. And now what are we facing in 1981? We're facing a long, bitter political fight over what? Not who's going to get more, but who's going to give up the least. The issue is no longer can we allow the outs to enjoy what they think is right, or even what we agree is their right, but how can we hold on to what we now have, which we know to be right, because we have it. That's the definition, isn't it, of the right. If it weren't that so many issues of justice and principle were involved, I'd suggest to you that the image of American political life today is of a group of dogs squabbling over scraps. And I'd remind you, when dogs scrabble over scraps, there's a lot of howling, and a few dogs get hurt. And there's going to be a lot of howling in America in the next years. There's going to be a lot of anger, there's going to be a lot of bitterness. There's going to be a lot of breaking down of the reserves, and people are going to say what they've always felt. I don't like Jews, so now I'm going to be able to say it. And before we get too high and mighty about that, I would suggest to you that if you listen to your friends, you're hearing among your friends more anti-black talk than you've ever heard in the last 10 or 15 years, because suddenly everybody's reserves are a little bit lowered. Frustration causes that to happen. Now, when dogs fight over scraps, when there's competition, those who believe in the survival of the fittest sort of are pleased that all of their rather ugly predictions are in fact going to take place. Competition is supposedly a great American virtue. It keeps us lean, it keeps us strong, well-muscled. We have to stay in condition. But I suggest to you also that the old truism has a certain truth to it, that anything's fair in love and war. And that when competition begins, the rules of fairness begin to dissolve. And we don't play so fair any longer. I would remind you that anti-Semitism in its medieval form was a religious phenomenon. It grew up out of religious competition. It grew up out of the totally unfair image of Judaism, which is presented to Christians in the New Testament. But it could be resolved. It could be resolved, as far as the majority was concerned, the Christian majority was concerned, in a simple way. Let Jews assimilate, let them go to the baptismal fountain, there's no more anti-Semitism. And even a lot of Jews tended to think in those terms. Theodor Herzl, before he came to Zionism, one day as a young assimilated Jew, had a dream that he would go and see the Pope. And he would tell the Pope that on a certain day all the Jews would in Vienna would go to the great cathedral in Vienna, and the young people would be converted en masse. All he had to do was to give assurances to the Jews that the church would no longer be responsible for any kind of anti-Semitic approach. But what happened when Jews assimilated, when Jews went to the baptismal font? They were undercutting the virtue of anti-Semitism. Why does anti-Semitism, anti-blackism, anti-Catholicism, anti-Vietnamism exist? Look at the anti-Vietnamism. Why is the Klan burning crosses in small fishing villages in Louisiana? Because the Vietnamese fishermen came over, and they proved to be better fishermen than the rednecks who've been fishing in Vietnam, in Louisiana for the last 100 years. One of the virtues of anti-anythingism is that it precludes competition. If Jews can't be admitted to the university, then Jews can't enter the free professions, and then the lawyers and the dentists and the doctors don't have to worry about Jewish competition, and they have the field to themselves. But when Jews don't play fair, and when Jews go to the baptismal font, and then they get into the university, a Jew has to be a Jew even when he's a Christian. And so you developed in the 19th century this theory of racist anti-Semitism, that a Jew was a Jew, whatever he was. Somehow being Jewish was a genetic element. It had nothing to do with belief. It had nothing to do with affirmation. It had nothing to do with community. It had simply something to do with genes, with blood, with inheritance. And now you were back to being able to prevent competition. But we're going to be competing all over the place in the next 10 or 20 years. And in that kind of competition, a lot of people aren't going to play fair. And when people don't play fair, well, a black remains a black even if he's a Harvard graduate. And a Jew remains a Jew even if he's an unsynagogue Jew. And we're going to find people who are going to be willing to try to reimpose old kinds of quota systems. And Jews and blacks and others who tend to be on the wrong side of quota systems had better beware when, in the name of liberalism and change, they invoke the validity of quota systems. They're trying to manipulate the same way the anti-Semite is. They're trying to do it for a good cause. It may in fact be a good cause. But once you open the door to this kind of approach, in societies like of ours, it's an awfully difficult thing to close it. In a world such as we live in then, the real world, I think that all of us are going to have to accept that the fact that the ease of human relationships, the openness of human relationships, which existed 20 years ago, will not necessarily exist in the next 20 years. And it suggests also that if there is any solution to the problems of anti-anythingism, that solution does not lie in education, because no one has ever proven that learning some facts about another tradition is a way to overcome one's prejudices about that tradition. Some of the worst anti-Semites of the 19th century were learned university professors who filled their days researching Judaism. They looked for what they wanted to find in it, and they distorted what they did find. But learned they were. It suggests that until we resolve some of the national problems, we're not going to resolve the prejudice problems. And since I do not believe that we're going to resolve the national problems in a way which will satisfy most materialist Americans, that is, by guaranteeing to most Americans that they'll continue to have more and more and more of the so-called good life, this suggests to me that what we really need is a kind of reorientation of national values, of the national spirit, a spiritual revolution in these United States. And that's going to take a long time and a lot of doing, and it's not going to come easily. And so although I know that most of those who offer a kind of social or economic social justice solution to the problems of anti-Semitism tell you that we've got to resolve the national problems, because I believe that most of these economic problems are not resolvable in a way which will serve the interests of most people. It seems to me that the real resolution of some of these problems lies with the spirit, with a religious change of heart, change of one's whole value structure. And that's not going to come overnight, and it's not going to come simply. How can I illustrate what I've been saying? A number of months ago, you may remember that a member of the Klan won the Democratic nomination for Congress in the Dearborn, Michigan area. And many Jews that I know saw this as proof of resurgent anti-Semitism of the European type. And there were all kinds of breast beatings and meetings about the fact that here was proof that many Americans were in fact involved in some kind of program pointed at the Jew. And obviously anti-Semitism was part of it. I don't doubt that the people who voted for them was anti-Semitic. I don't doubt that many people out there are anti-Semitic. But many of you may have seen in the paper just these last few days that it was in Dearborn, Michigan, among the auto workers, that the rebellion, the tax rebellion, is taking place. And I assure you that these automobile workers are the same people who voted for this Democratic candidate for Congress. What's the vote? Anti-Jewish or simply frustration? No jobs, no high-paying jobs at least, no certainty about their families, lack of capacity to adjust to an increasingly complex society, lack of education to know, you know, where, how effective, how you can work for change effectively, all these things impact on what these men have been doing. Let me take an illustration that's of a slightly different nature. A great deal has been made in panels such as these and others about the fact that the president of the Southern Baptist Association delivered himself a speech in which he said, among other things, that God doesn't hear the prayers of Jews. I must say, I almost agree with him. I almost agree with him because God can't hear the prayers that are never said. And Jews aren't praying. But I also would remind you, that that speech was given 3 months before, 2.5 months before it was released to the newspapers, that it was known to Jewish sources during that whole period of time, that it was released by one of our national defense agencies precisely at the time when they were engaging in their annual membership campaign, and widely publicized because of the needs of that campaign. What I'm suggesting to you is that anti-Semitism is in some ways a very important element in the life of the Jewish community. That we have a symbiotic relationship towards anti-Semitism. We need it. Some of us do. For some Jews, there's no other reason for being Jewish than that they don't want us to be Jewish. There's absolutely no positive content to one's Jewish identity. Anti-Semitism is important in Jewish life. We thrive on it. Our annual drives depend on it. That's a sobering thought. And it leads me to the conclusion that one of the things that the American Jewish community must do is to somehow reorient its priorities and its structures so that there's some positive content, some positive reason to be Jewish. Let me talk a little bit about the Holocaust. The Holocaust is another one of these issues I very rarely talk about. I find it overwhelming. I find myself reduced to silence by it. I find myself disturbed whenever a speaker, after a good meal, stands before an audience who've also had a good meal and begins to remind everybody about Bergen-Belsen and Majdanek and Dachau and Auschwitz, pulls at the heartstrings, and so on. One of the realities of American Jewish life 1980 is that the Holocaust, like anti-Semitism, is almost the image of anti-Semitism, or it is the symbol of anti-Semitism, has become terribly important to us, and for many Jews it has become the sum and substance of their faith. There were 93 courses in the Holocaust offered in American Canadian universities last year. One half of these courses were offered in universities which had no other offering in Jewish studies. There are now 3 magazines in the United States devoted to the Holocaust. I said, as chairman of the Academic Advisory Council of the Jewish Foundation, which gives money for postgraduate Jewish studies to young people preparing themselves in Jewish studies for their doctoral degrees. This year, half of the requests for fellowships which I read were proposals to do doctoral dissertations in the Holocaust. There's a man named Irving Greenberg, rather nice man, who's a traditional rabbi who has made something of a name himself with federations around the country, who has now created something called the Holocaust Resource Center. I asked him one day, what do you do, provide the dead bodies? The Holocaust Resource Center. And he's suggesting to us that we ought to have a ceremony for the day which memorializes the Holocaust, where we eat the potato peelings of Bergen-Belsen and the apple cores from Dachau. This image is, of course, the bread of affliction which we eat on the Passover. But I would remind you, as I tried to remind him, that the bread of affliction is simply the beginning of the Passover ceremony. The Passover ceremony is a great affirmation of redemption, the God who redeems. It's a promise of the future, not simply a fixation on death. What is the positive content of the Holocaust? What does it say about social concerns? What does it say about our human development? What does it say about us as individuals? In a sense, and I don't mean this cruelly, it gives to the Jew a certain sense of specialness because some other Jew was chosen. It gives us a perverse sense of mission. We're going to hold a torch alive. But there are 613 commandments in the Torah, and the phrase Zachor Amalek, to remember the capacity of the human being for evil, is only one of the 613 commandments. There's 612 others, which deal with social concerns, which deal with justice, with respect for parents, respect for ourselves, mercy, loving kindness, caring for our neighbors, we care for ourselves. All of this has no meaning when a world is fixated on death, fixated on persecution, fixated on fear, on anti-Semitism. And when you add to this Holocaust fixation, if you will, which has become so important to Jewish life, the political events of the last months, you can understand the ethos in which Jews have begun to be so timid and so fearful. What's happened these last months? Simply this. The country has moved right, clearly, decisively. And for many Jews, and for many understandable reasons, Jews are afraid of the move towards the right. Most of the Jews who came to the United States came because the governments of privilege, the elitist governments of Europe, persecuted Jews. And we knew that our enemies were in the established privileged classes, in the established state church, whatever it was, and in those who wanted to maintain their privileges. And so the ethos of American Jewry has always been one where we looked for understanding from the left. The left was a combination of ethnic groups, immigrant groups like ourselves. It spoke more or less to our needs, and therefore we felt at home and comfortable with it. And I'm not going to recite to you the long history of anti-Semitism, which has been created by and dispersed by and propagandized by the right. It exists. But I want to suggest to you tonight, there's an absolutely mirror image, an equal degree of anti-Semitism on the left. It's not a question of one being good and one being bad. They're both what they are. In 1881, five young Russian revolutionaries, children of the privileged class, led by a girl, 28-year-old girl, who was the daughter of the former commanding general of the garrison in St. Petersburg, assassinated the Tsar, Alexander II. Russia, which unlike the United States, was a country which had only one outgroup, it wasn't a pluralistic society in our sense, and that outgroup were the 5 million Jews who lived in the western parts of Russia, particularly in the Pale settlement. Russia immediately reacted by blaming the Jews for the kinds of ideas which these five upper-class Russian Orthodox young people espoused: anarchism, socialism, assassination, attack on Mother Russia. The pogroms began, the great exodus of the Jewish community from Russia began. What's interesting is not that the pogroms were begun by and supported by and in a sense created by the right, and they were, but by the young leftist movement in the Soviet Union, the Narodnikovs. The very people who had assassinated the Tsar applauded the pogroms, because they said this was the first sign that the peasants were having their consciousness raised, that they were willing to take fate into their own hands, that they beat the heads of a few pure Jews, so be it. I remind you that Karl Marx wrote a famous little pamphlet, a spurious little pamphlet on the world without Jews. I remind you that post-war Poland has had at least three bloody pogroms since the end of the Second World War. A number of purges of whatever Jews remained in Poland after the war, organized by, stimulated by the left-wing communist government of Poland. I remind you that it is among the Socialist Workers' Party, National Labor Party, these extreme left-wing groups in the United States, that much of the most active anti-Semitic literature is being disseminated. Some of you may have seen the signs were held aloft at the trial of Dunajec down in the courthouse. You know, the Holocaust is a hoax, 6 million lies. We immediately assumed that this was the Ukrainian community that was doing this. It wasn't. It was a Trotskyite National Socialist Workers' Party who simply infiltrated into that group. The existence of a Jewish community, middle class, largely middle class, largely literate community, a community of people who do not believe that they must give up their identity, who do not believe that the means justify the end, stands as a danger to those people on the left who want to organize and manipulate people, who insist that history must work out a certain way and no one can stand in the way of their iron law, economic laws. It reminds you that it is among the left-wing movements in the Third World, the terrorists who have attacked Israel again and again, have been found. That the terrorist movements in Europe have been trained by the PLO and have often taken Jewish targets for their operation. quite apart from their rest of their operations in the world. Now, what I'm suggesting to you is this. The world's not a nice place. There's no reason to believe that the world's going to be in a much better place 10 years from now or 20 years from now. Anti-Semitism is not limited to the left or to the right. It exists. It was not the right-wing Americans who imposed the phony refugee solutions of the late 1930s. It was the Roosevelt government. It was not the left which imposed the immigration restrictions in the 1920s. It was a right-wing government. What I'm suggesting to you is that as long as America's government remains essentially in some kind of relative centrist position, where 80% of the people are somehow involved in where the parties are, and that's clear. As long as we're in that kind of world, we're going to have some evidences of anti-Semitism, we're going to have episodes which seem to show disinterest for causes which Jews hold dear. But there's no reason to believe that America will change markedly or drastically from the kind of government positions which we have traditionally held. Than they had in Europe 40 years ago, 50 years ago, but not one that I would insist needs remain always fundamentally different. If I say America is different today, it doesn't mean that America could not have a terrible kind of reversal in the near future or in the future. The first is that we're a constitutional democracy. There are limits to what a legislature can do. It's written in the law. There are limits to what a police force can do. There are statutory limits. And this is important because the popular will can move rapidly in one direction or another, moved by, fanned by the flames of frustration or fear or hate. And I would suggest that this leads me to the conclusion that Jews ought to be very careful before they begin to sponsor any constitutional amendment for any reason. Because once you get in the habit of amending the basic law of the land, almost any amendment can go through. And we ought particularly to be leery of any kind of constitutional convention where the agenda is open-ended. And secondly, I remind you that our society is infinitely complex. I've never quite understood what's meant by the term cultural pluralism, but at the very least, it suggests to me that the anti-person has a problem. In Europe, there are very few scapegoats. Catholic France had the Huguenots. Anglican England had the Puritans. Lutheran Germany had some Catholics in the south. But everyone in Europe was a member of the mystic body of Christ, with the exception of Gypsies and Jews. We were the visible, omnipresent, in their minds, target. There was no other. I've been fascinated by the Klan in recent years. The Klan's got a real problem. Who are they going to go after? They excluded the Catholics because they found it was too complex to include them any longer. America had too many, there were too many other targets. And there were the blacks. And I understand the Klan burnings in Texas now are to a certain degree against the Hispanics, the Mexican Americans. They're the Jews. They're the Vietnamese. The Cambodians. There are a lot of targets. And the left, the right, the radical groups of all sides are confused because it's not easy to know whom you should pick as the ideal symbol of frustration, or others will understand who you're after. Cultural pluralism is a great safeguard for Jews because now we're one among many who are different. And American society is different to this effect, that I don't think we know any longer who the majority is. I've got a few WASP friends who claim they're a minority. And I think in many ways they are. It's not clear who the majority is. In France, you know when you're talking about a Frenchman, whom you're talking about. He speaks French, he likes wine, he's Catholic. In England, when you talk about an Englishman, you know you're talking about. You're not talking about a Welshman, you're not talking about a Scotchman. You're not talking about one of the Jews of England, you're talking about an Anglican member of the establishment. You're not talking about a Cockney. And who are you talking about when you're talking about the quintessential American? You can't pick him out, you can't picture him. And so those have got to hate, and everybody hates to a certain degree, those have got to have prejudice, and everybody has prejudice to a certain degree, have a terrible, terrible problem. Thank God. Their problem is our safety. I mean that seriously. And that's an important difference between the American situation, 1981, and the European situation between the two world wars or before the world war. What do I suggest? I'm suggesting that Jews should forget for a while about anti-Semitism and concentrate on deciding what it means to be Jewish. I'm suggesting that if I were a Jew who had been brought out of the Soviet Union by various kinds of pressures, who wanted to come out because he was Jewish, who had lived in a Jewish society where there was no Jewish education, there was very little ritual possible, there were no modern Jewish elements to what he did, what he knew. And I was brought to Cleveland, Ohio. And I was welcomed here by the hospitality for which Cleveland is noted. And I wasn't particularly put off by the Cleveland winter because in Moscow it's worse. And I was given a job by some nice Jewish businessman, and I was taken to the Jewish Community Center and taught English by some nice Jewish ladies. And my children were welcomed into various athletic programs by nice Jewish children. I think I'd still be left with a real problem. What does being Jewish mean to all these Jews? What's involved here? What does a Jewish community stand for? Scholarship, learning, spirituality, social consciousness. I was fascinated the other day. I picked up the Cleveland magazine. And here was a story all about the Cleveland Jewish community. Written by a nice man, born again Christian. And what did I read about? Some nice, rich men. Some socially eager Jewish men and women. And somehow it was a matter of great concern to everybody that a rabbi had gotten up in a social club and said a motzi. Fascinating. What do we stand for? Survival for what? Somebody's going to hate me. I want them to hate me because I stand for something. I want to hate them to hate me because I believe in justice, or I believe in democracy, or I believe in learning. I believe in the things that Jewish tradition would believe. That's not where we've been. You and I. We've been worrying about what they think, what they're like, what they feel. And I suggest to you that we lost our cool in 1980 because we're not so sure what we feel like anymore. It's not the rabbis who've lost their cool. It's not that. It's people who really don't know why, where they stand in this very difficult world which we're a part of. They don't know where the Jewish community stands or what it stands for. So you've asked me, what does this whole episode suggest? suggests what the real world is really like. I've always known that, I think. It suggests what the Jewish community really needs to make as its priority. I'll leave to the priests, to the ministers, the gurus of this town, the problem of anti-Semitism. They're capable of dealing with it. The ones I know are spiritually decent human people. As a rabbi, I've got to say this to you. That our response in the last year or two suggests to me that we've got a lot of soul searching to do, a lot of seeking to do. We've got to find this positive content of our Jewish commitment. And when we do, a nasty word, closed door, graffiti on the wall of our synagogues is not going to shake us that much. Because part of being Jewish is to have one's eyes open to what life is really like. We Jews have prided ourselves that our tradition is not a pie-in-the-sky tradition. It's a realistic tradition of how real people live in the real world. One of the truths about the real world is that it's anti-Semitic. It's anti a lot of things. And if we're going to live in that world, let's live with becoming pride. And the only way to live with pride is to know where you stand and what you believe. Enough of the sermon. Let me pause here and try now and answer whatever questions you have. And thank you for your attention.